This is Cradle My Heart Radio with your host, Kim Cotola. Cradle My Heart Radio, preventing abortion and helping those it hurts.
This is where the healing begins. Oh, this is where the healing starts. When you come to where you're broken within, the light meets the dark. The light meets the dark.
And now, Kim Cotola and Cradle My Heart Radio.
Our mission here, as you know, is to prevent abortion and to help those whom it hurts. And one of the very best ways to help the post-abortive is to present the truth of what abortion is and what abortion does, not only to the women and men who choose it, but also to the children whose lives are lost through abortion. And as we're going to discover and uncover, there is absolutely no dispute that unborn children are full members of the human family. And so when we talk about this, we're going to take an approach this time that abortion is wrong because it breaches the human inclusiveness that all of us ought to be pursuing as members of the human community. This is an idea that has been given enlivenment and so much support, both morally, legally, and in so many ways, from Professor Francis Beckwith, who is our guest. And he's a professor at Baylor University, as well as now serving on the faculty at the University of Colorado Boulder as a visiting scholar in conservative thought and policy. At Baylor, he teaches philosophy and church-state studies. And we really appreciate you making time to be with us. Thank you so much for joining us, Francis Beckwith.
You're welcome. It's great to be on. Thank you.
So as we think about your case for human inclusiveness, I think that this is such a wonderful approach to helping people understand the issue of abortion beyond the rhetoric, whether it's pro-life rhetoric or abortion rights advocacy rhetoric. What you have done for us in your book, Defending Life and Elsewhere, is to help frame this as a question of human inclusiveness. And I want you to talk about the steps that go into that as you would build the case for someone not familiar with this approach.
Sure. I mean, it seems to me that the question in abortion, as with any question when we're dealing with how we should treat other human beings or other beings at all, is the being we're talking about a person or a member of the human community? To give you an illustration, one of my dear friends, Gregory Kokel, likes to use this example. He says, imagine you're sitting in a chair by a window, and your back is to the room, and you hear your daughter come up to you, your 8-year-old daughter, and she asks, "Daddy, can I kill it?" What would be your next question? Your next question would be, "What is it?" That is, to answer the question of should I or can I kill it, you have to know the sort of thing that it is. And when we're talking about abortion, what often gets lost in this debate, it is the fundamental question, who and what are we and can we know it? Now, as many people know, there are people on the other side of this issue who support abortion rights who argue that there's something about the unborn child, the fetus, that allows them to exclude that being from the human community. And the case I make in the book is that, yes, there are differences between the unborn and those that are older, right? But that's true of us at every point in our development. So there is a difference between the infant and the toddler and the adolescent and the adult and the elderly person. We're the same thing along the continuum. So the reason why I use the language that I do in the book is that in our society today, there's such an emphasis on inclusiveness and understanding others and not discriminating against people based on characteristics that are irrelevant. And I think that kind of reasoning applies handsomely to the abortion debate. So the question that I answer in the book is who and what are we? And it's clear we are, in fact, obviously human beings, but we're human beings from the moment we come into existence. And as we develop, what really happens, it isn't as if human beings are artifacts that gain parts over time. We are whole beings from the beginning, and every aspect of our development is merely an unfolding of what we already are. So yes, the fetus, the unborn child, can't do things that the toddler and the adolescent can do. But what those later stages of ourselves do is simply a perfection of what we already are from the very beginning, human beings.
Professor Beckwith, I want to interrupt you just for a moment, because this part of your case is so important. And as we go, Professor Beckwith is going to share with us this fourfold argument that human inclusiveness means we may not kill the unborn child, and that every abortion does so. But as something that you've asserted there and that you're arguing for is that we're whole human beings from conception forward. And if someone wants to dispute that or argue it, they really don't have any scientific evidence on their side. I mean, I think it's important for us to understand that what you've asserted there is supported scientifically, really without dispute in the scientific community, that life begins at conception.
That's right. I mean, there's no doubt about that. The very beginning of each of our existences, we begin as a one-celled zygote, and that is a consequence of the germ cells from both the mother and the father. Each of those germ cells, the sperm and the ovum, cease to exist after fertilization, and you have a whole new being. And all that being does is simply develop itself. It becomes what it already is. In the same way, think about it this way. You know, I'm a college professor, so I see students who arrive on the college campus who have incomplete knowledge about things. When they develop their intellectual powers, they're only becoming what they already are. That is, they're only performing what they're ordered to by nature. And so in terms of the science is very clear. You have at the beginning an entity, a human being, that from that point forward simply develops into what it already is. What you see in terms of development is a manifestation of the nature that was there from the beginning. Those that, in fact, support abortion rights, they can't really deny that. But they do offer arguments to defend abortion, but they can't actually say that it's not a human being.
And we can't really object to something that you've said there, that the sperm and the egg cease to exist when the new entity comes into being. Because, you know, you'll hear a facile argument, but I hear it, you know, in intellectual circles too, that, well, it's a fertilized egg, or which is a misnomer, according to what you've just said. But also you will hear that, well, in the reproductive act, millions of sperm die. In a woman's monthly cycle, an egg dies. And so it's, you know, there's nothing wrong with killing this fertilized egg. But what you've said there is so important, that the two components cease to exist as separate entities. And this new being is a complete human being, albeit, you know, not well developed, but nonetheless complete.
That's right. The sperm and ovum are the parts of the owners. That is to say, the ovum is the one, you know, the one cell in her body that's actually unlike any of the others, right? All the other cells are what are called somatic cells. Those are the cells that make up, you know, the parts of our bodies, right? Whether it's arms and legs or eyes and ears. But the germ cells, which in the man is the sperm and the woman the ovum, are unique. They are actually made or designed for the purpose of joining with the other so that a new thing can come into existence. But they are, at the end of the day, just simply the parts of each of the parents. And the question then is, does something new arise? And it's pretty clear that it does.
All right. So the unborn entity from the moment of conception is a full-fledged member of the human community by virtue of its kind. That's our starting point.
That's correct. Yes. That's premise one.
And so now we get into morals, and now we get into ethical ground and philosophical ground with your second portion of the argument.
That's right. The second premise of the argument is it is prima facie morally wrong to kill another member of that community or the human community. Now, the prima facie is a Latin phrase, and it means simply on the face of it. All things being equal, it's wrong to kill a human being. And I say it that way because there are times in which killing a human being could be justified. For example, in an act of self-defense or in a just war. Many people argue that capital punishment is morally justified. So all it's saying here is that all things being equal, and I probably should have said, I could have actually said an innocent, it's always wrong to kill an innocent human being intentionally. But nevertheless, yeah, all things being equal, it's wrong to kill a human being. In other words, the person that's doing the killing has the obligation to prove that it's justified.
Okay. And so as we start thinking about unpacking that, let's anticipate some of the objections that you've encountered. Let us know some of the objections that you've encountered so we can anticipate them in our conversation.
Sure. So one objection that you'll often hear, and it's really not focused on that premise directly, but you'll hear something like this. You're right that it's all things being equal, morally wrong to kill a member of the human community. But the objection could be something like this. Yes, the fetus is in fact a human being, but it's not a person. And that objection is conceding to me or to pro-lifers that genetically the fetus is a human being, but it is not morally a human being. Now, for a lot of your listeners, that's going to sound really weird. Because for most people, and I think most people are right here, that all human beings are persons, but that there are some bioethicists and philosophers who argue that some human beings aren't persons. And what they mean by that is that, well, persons are human beings that have certain sorts of characteristics, like the ability to think rationally, to have a self-concept, have self-consciousness and so forth. And they say, look, it turns out that for most of pregnancy, the fetus, the unborn child, doesn't have those characteristics. Therefore, it's not a person. My response is twofold. One, it seems that you can come up with some very good counterexamples. When I'm asleep or temporarily unconscious, or any one of us are in that state, we don't cease to be persons. What we cease to be doing is engaging in personal activities, but not engaging in personal activities doesn't mean you're not a person. Just like supposing we say that a human being is a being that has the natural power to see. If I come across a blind person, that doesn't mean that that person is not a human being. All that it means is that they lack the power to exercise something that they are ordered to by nature. And so when we talk about unborn children not having the present ability to exercise these powers, it doesn't mean they're not persons. It just means that they are persons that have not fulfilled their intrinsic potential, just like in later in life, many of us have potentials for other things that we never acquire. I don't speak French, but I have a potential to speak French. That doesn't mean I'm not a person. So I think that that's one response that you'll hear. Some other ones could be, isn't it the case that in some pregnancies the woman's life is in danger and that she may have to have an abortion to save her own life? And there I think we have to be really careful. There are cases in which terminating a pregnancy is the only way to save a woman's life. But in those situations, the pro-lifer, I think, has to argue that there's a difference between terminating a pregnancy and intentionally killing an unborn child to end the pregnancy. So to give a typical example, Supposing a woman has a cancerous uterus and there is a child developing in her uterus, and the only way that her life can be saved is to remove the uterus. That kind of situation, I think, is justified, because if you don't do that, what will happen is both will die. In addition, you're not actually killing the child. What you're doing is simply removing the uterus, although you know one of the side effects is the death of the child. So you may hear that kind of objection as well.
Francis Beckwith is our guest. He's professor at Baylor University and now a visiting scholar at Colorado. And, you know, as we think about this, many of the arguments that you will hear as to, or assertions really, as to when a fetus or an embryo becomes a person seem to be based on coming back to, you know, your argument about inclusiveness. They're not like us. They don't think like us. They can't feel yet. They don't look human, some people will even say, you know, on a very primitive argument. But what we're talking about here is the fact that, for example, an organism of its kind doesn't need a brain to be fully human at the very earliest stages of development. If left to develop, it will continue to grow, and that will come. The lack of a brain doesn't make someone not human. I mean, that would require that they would be start as something and become human, which never happens. And so I think that, you know, it's so helpful to keep coming back to inclusiveness, because if we can exclude people as persons, then you're right. Morally, it's we can do whatever we want. And so we've seen that the unborn entity from the moment of conception, full-fledged member of the human community. And now we see that it is wrong, morally wrong, to kill a member of the human community. Without cause, you know, an innocent human. And so let's talk about the third premise of your argument.
The third premise is every successful abortion kills an unborn entity, a full-fledged member of the human community. And here I'm alluding to the fact that the typical abortion, the purpose of it is to not only terminate the pregnancy, that is to say, to make sure the pregnancy ends. After all, you can end a pregnancy by giving birth, right? So the purpose is to actually kill the fetus, that there's no doubt about that. And I also am careful in that premise to make sure that I'm not suggesting that, like in the case of the cancerous uterus removal, that I'm not saying that is actually technically even an abortion, because in that case, you're not intending to kill the fetus. You're actually intending to save the mother's life. So, yeah, every successful abortion kills an unborn entity. In fact, there have been cases in which children have survived. And one of the difficulties in medicine today is, how do you deal with that? And there have been laws passed, in fact, a federal law called it's got a really long name, like the Infant Survival Protection Act or something like that, that's actually put in place so that if a child does survive, the government has an obligation, or the hospital has an obligation, to make sure that that child is treated like a regular born child.
And how did that legislation, as we're thinking about that, how did that legislation come into being? You know, many of our listeners may not be aware that abortion was not legal prior to Roe versus Wade. Some states had made it so in the 1960s, but at the time that, for example, the Constitution of the United States was written, abortion was illegal. It remains illegal many, many places in the world, and we're one of the few countries where it's legal through all 9 months of pregnancy. I think we stand with places like China and North Korea in that distinction.
Yeah.
So talk about the necessity for this legislation that says, look, if the abortion doesn't kill a child, you may not go forward and intentionally complete the act.
Yeah, now that I recall it, it's actually called the Born a Live Infant Protection Act. That was the exact name of the legislation. It was signed by George W. Bush when he was president. It's got an interesting history. I actually am friends with the professor, Professor Hadley Arkus from Amherst College, who actually was the brainchild behind the bill. And the purpose of it, clearly, there are not many of these cases that happen. But for Professor Arkus, he understood that the law has an educative role. That is, even though this kind of legislation is not going to stop many abortions, and there's rarely going to be a case where the government may have to intercede so that this law is applied in individual cases. But the fact is that it actually forces us to think, okay, if a child that survives the abortion has to be taken care of, well, how does it differ from the child that didn't survive the abortion? It's the same kind of thing, isn't it? And so I think this kind of legislation, I think, is important. And some pro-lifers don't like this kind of legislation. They say, well, you're not really, doing anything except for something symbolic. And my argument is that it's more than just symbolic. That is, there are actual cases like this. And even though there are a few of them, what's wrong with being symbolic? Because the fact is, symbols, meanings, how we talk about things actually does influence the way we behave and think. And so if enough people start thinking more about the nature of the unborn as a consequence of this legislation, I think it plays an important educative role.
Well, and I think it helps correct the moral flaw in our reasoning that says a child is endowed with humanity at the will of its mother. If a child is wanted, it's a human being. And there are large numbers of people who believe that and who think that way, but it isn't so. You can't argue for it from logic, from morals, from ethics. You can't argue for that on any basis.
Yeah, I think this kind of legislation, again, forces us to have to address those very questions those very issues that you're raising. And the reality is, even though people usually have some opinion about abortion, most people have not thought very deeply about the issue, unless, of course, it involves a kind of situation in their own life. But generally, people have not really thought through the question. I'm teaching a course this semester at Baylor called Intro to Medical Ethics, and we're going over the topic of abortion actually right now, this week. And I'm really surprised at how many of my students, most of whom who come from Christian homes, hadn't really thought about the issue. Some of them actually have views that surprise me. Some of them have more liberal views than I would have expected. Others, have views that I, would have expected. But what really shocks me is how little they've actually thought about it.
Hmm. And so as we come to the conclusion of the argument that abortion is wrong, this isn't a matter of opinion. It isn't a matter of you have to believe in the Bible. This is the logical conclusion from the premises that you've laid out. And so talk about that, Professor Beckwith, because, in our age of moral relativism and postmodernism, where, your truth is your truth, mine is mine, how can we possibly make such a claim that abortion is morally wrong?
Well, I'll read the conclusion. Therefore, every successful abortion is prima facie morally wrong. It follows from the premises. That is, if unborn human beings are full-fledged members of the human community and it's wrong to kill innocent full-fledged members of the human community, it inexorably follows that abortion is, in fact, morally wrong. I don't think there's any way around the reasoning except for the sorts of objections that I've already brought up, and I don't think those objections in any way succeed. Now, obviously, abortion is more than about logic, but the logical arguments have to be there. I have a dear friend I went to graduate school with who he and I used to argue about lots of things. And several years after I had gotten out of graduate school and the topic of abortion came up, just as we had argued about in graduate school, he told me and confessed that he had changed his mind and become pro-life. And he said, initially, when you were giving me these arguments, I was upset and belligerent about it. He says, but, they kind of stuck with me. And over time, my heart was softened. So I think that, you know, arguments aren't everything, but they're not nothing either. They do make a difference. People, in fact, you know, they may not be initially converted when you make the argument, but they, I think they do stick with people, and they think about it.
Professor Francis Beckwith teaches philosophy and church-state studies, as well as being co-director of the program in Philosophical Studies of Religion in the Institute for Studies of Religion at Baylor University. And he has also been named just recently the Visiting Professor of Conservative Thought and Policy at University of Colorado Boulder. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now stay with us. Coming up on Faith Radio, your phone calls as we take a look at some of the top stories on the life issue in the news this week. And our phone lines are open. 1-800-811-3003. It's 1-800-811-3003 here at Cradle My Heart Radio.
A safe place to connect with others, finding God's love after abortion.
This is Cradle My Heart Radio.
This is where the healing begins. Oh, this is where the healing starts. When you come to where you're broken again, the light meets the dark. The light meets the dark.
Cradle My Heart with Kim Cotola. Join the conversation. Call toll-free 800-811-3003. 800-811-3003.
Good evening, and thank you so much for joining us. Kim Cotola, your host here for Cradle My Heart Radio, and you're you, and we're all together, and I appreciate that. Thank you so much for being with us. This is a topic that requires an intentional act for you to give it your time. And so I really do appreciate that. I think it's a lot easier to not think about the issue of abortion. It's a lot easier to not think about the controversy, to not think about what needs to happen in the aftermath of abortion, if that is part of your story. And so I applaud you giving it your attention, because there are those who are struggling. There are those who, like me, had no idea what to do after abortion, especially with the spiritual problems that I was experiencing. I thought God would hate me. I thought that God would never accept me. I thought decent church-going people would never accept me. I thought that this was something that I was going to need to keep secret the rest of my life, and that I could never possibly undo on any level. And it turns out that those feelings are very common, but they're not what God has in mind for us. And one of the things that I really want you to grasp, if you're someplace along a journey of walking out what it is to live in light of an abortion in your past, is this whole issue of how God sees us. Is he disgusted by the choice that we made? Is he repelled by it? Is he angry? Is he judging us? Is he waiting to punish us? Is he already punishing us with the adversity we may be experiencing in our lives? And in those questions flow out of a guilty conscience, and also out of the, you know, spiritual enemy of our souls, who lives ever to accuse us and to condemn us, as we talked about last week. But I just return again and again to the story of Jesus with the woman at the well, because abortion for so many of us was a cover-up. It was meant to protect an image and a reputation. I had a conversation with somebody this week who said, yes, that's what was going on. She was the first in her family to go to college, and she just could not face going home and telling everybody who was so proud of her that she was going to be the standard bearer for the family, that no, she was just like everybody else. the example that Christ gave us in his exchange with that woman of Samaria at the well that day is such a beautiful picture, because he's not scandalized by what we've done. He's not shocked. He's not surprised. He doesn't hate us. He doesn't hate the need that we met in an inappropriate choice. He is coming to speak with us about how, you know, it's a cliche, looking for love in the wrong places. That was his diagnosis for the woman at the well, and telling her that you've got a worship problem. You're worshiping the wrong God and the wrong things in this life. And she didn't want to accept that right away. She wanted to talk about, you know, I'm upright in the eyes of my religious folk. And he said, if you knew who was talking to you, you would ask for living water and I would give it to you. And she said, yes, I do want that. And that's when the real conversation began. We all have a thirst for something worth our worship. That's what Jesus comes to reveal to us. That's the key that he holds, and that he has come to give to you and to me, and to people who are guilty of other things that represent disordered worship, whether it would be greed, because that was an underlying factor, I think, in my choice for abortion. More of a fear of poverty than trying to just, you know, build wealth, but a fear of poverty that would drive you to do something that's morally wrong probably is greed. So I want to talk with you, especially as we are facing in the next week Palm Sunday, which is a week from today, the story of Zacchaeus, you know, recovering from the emotional and spiritual impact of abortion includes what happened for Zacchaeus when Jesus came to his house, and that is restitution. Redemptive giving is what I like to call it, because restitution isn't a part of the new covenant. Jesus Christ is our restitution. But you and I still have available this dynamic of redemptive giving, which is not the same as trying to give to atone for sin, nor is it driven by guilt. It's not like charitable giving in the scriptures, which is mandated that it to be done in private to preserve the dignity of the person who is in need. And it's not the tithe, which is giving to the Lord's work, a response to God's abundant provision in our lives. What Zacchaeus did when Jesus came to his house was to give in a way that followed along the law in Leviticus for the sin offering and the guilt offering. And in order for you to really get this, I wrote a whole chapter about this in my book, In Cradle My Heart. But Zacchaeus' story is written in Luke 19, 1 through 10. And he climbs up into the sycamore tree as Jesus is making his way through Jericho on his way to Jerusalem on, you know, the first Palm Sunday, when he is about to be anointed by the people as the Messiah. And so Zacchaeus climbs up in the tree, and Jesus says, come down, I'm coming to your house. He goes to his house and they have a conversation, and Jesus says, salvation has come. And Zacchaeus says, I'm going to give you back all of my ill-gotten wealth, and I'm going to give to the poor as well. Well, Zacchaeus was a chief tax collector, which means that he was a Jew who was oppressing his fellow Jews under Roman rule. And so this made him truly despicable in the eyes of, you know, his countrymen, but should have been in the eyes of the Lord as well. I'm sure the onlookers were very upset when Jesus chose, out of all the people assembled there to praise him, to go to Zacchaeus' home, a henchman of the Romans, betrayer of his own people, his Jewish kinsmen. It must have looked all wrong. I mean, they were thinking Jesus had come to liberate the Jews from the oppressors, not join them at their lavish home from his, you know, extortion of above and beyond the tax for his own ill-gotten gains, that is. And being with Jesus changed Zacchaeus. It wasn't that, you know, and this is what always had, this is the pattern. Instead of Jesus being sullied by the sinners that he chose to hang with, they were changed and his purity was imputed to them. He makes this former extortionist a generous man. When Zacchaeus gave back what he had taken and gave even more as restitution, he was following the Levitical law for that guilt offering. You can read it in Leviticus 5. So in our, and it talks about what happens again with a worship disorder. If a person acts unfaithfully and sins unintentionally against the Lord's holy things, he shall bring his guilt offering to the Lord, a ram without defect from the flock. This is Leviticus 5. According to your valuation in silver by shekels, in terms of the shekels of the sanctuary for a guilt offering. So he'll make restitution for that which he has sinned against the holy thing, and shall add to it a fifth part of it and give it to the priest. And the priest will make atonement for him. What are the holy things? Well, it was the things of the temple, the things of the sanctuary, but also other people. So in our time, the Lord's holy things includes our bodies, and by extension, the bodies of our unborn children. And this is such a key for those who are trapped in regret and say, I want to undo it, but there's nothing I can do to undo that decision. It's irrevocable. And I've got to live with it the rest of my life. And I wish I could go back and undo it. Well, God has this provision of restitution as a person who also appropriated what was not mine to take when I made the decision to end the life of my unborn child. Again, I'm not talking about atonement. That's not required under the new covenant. Only the blood of Jesus Christ can forgive our sins. But the dynamic of restitution still serves to restore our standing. It changes us. It doesn't change what we did. But it is an outward sign that we are a new creation in Christ, that the old has gone and the new has come. And so it very importantly restores our standing with ourselves. It gives us a new memory. It gives us a healing perspective. It gives us a positive ending to the grief and guilt that abortion brings. The Bible tells us that the chief tax collector was the worst of the worst in terms of the brutality against his fellow Jews. And wow, I don't know. I mean, if you experience that, but I often felt beyond redemption due to the brutal and traumatic nature of the abortion experience. It is very hard to shirk the hardness of heart, which had allowed me to deny the very humanity of my own unborn child, my own people. But Zacchaeus understood that by giving his fortune away, he was sealing publicly the transformation that God had privately worked in his heart through that visit with Jesus Christ. So not only was he forgiven, but Jesus provided a way for him to be restored to fellowship in the community. How else would anybody believe he had been changed? You know, those whom he had been victimizing. And so restitution, redemptive giving can take many, many forms in our time. We've got some of those suggestions listed at cradlemyheart.org tonight. But if this is a concept that you're already familiar with, and if you are, you know, searching and looking for ways to give, I'd love to hear from you tonight. 1-800-811-3003. 800-811-3003. We had a comment in response to the blog post on this. A reader who said, we have found great comfort in donating to New Life Family Services in our area, which is an organization providing support for crisis pregnancies, teen health care, and emotional healing after abortion. And the comment goes on to say, I like that NLFS equally and actively discusses the effects of abortion on women, which is a topic often minimalized in the whole area of Christian-based support for life. And so the blog and book nicely work out from the Old Testament and Zacchaeus how restitution can help our healing. And it was an important act to separate that restitution, which came later from trying to earn my way back to God. to peace for my awful decision, which came earlier. And I think that this reader is exactly right. We can't start from, I want to give and make this right, because that means that we're still trying to earn something which God has freely given us. And it can't ever work that way. And God won't allow it to work that way, because that would mean that would diminish what Christ has already done for us and what he himself said as his blood was flowing out from the cross, that it was finished and complete. There is nothing we can add to what he has already done for us, knowing what we would do. He did that for us. And so giving to a pregnancy help center is a great way to make restitution, you know, helping others to make a better choice than you and I may have made. Speaking up for the unborn within your circle of influence is a redemptive way of giving to those who don't yet know the truth. And it's a risk in our culture. It may cost us close relationships. It may cost us something in our friendships or with family members. They may change our opinion, their opinion of us radically. That may be a costly gift to speak up for the unborn. Have you found a way to give so that it has redeemed the pain of abortion? You know, nothing can redeem the sin of abortion other than the perfect sacrifice of Christ. But have you found a way to give that can help you and has helped you relieve the pain? Would love to hear from you. 1-800-811-3003. That's our toll-free number open for you tonight. You don't have to share your name with us. We will respect your privacy, of course. 1-800-811-3003. And for our callers tonight, we do have a copy of 40 Days for Life. David B. Wright and Sean Carney, the founders of that international prayer movement that has saved, I believe, now over almost 12,000 lives through prayer outside of abortion facilities. The current campaign is going on through March 20th. So if you'd like to read the book about how the movement began, that is our gift tonight for our callers who join us on the air. Call now, 1-800-811-3003.
A safe place to connect with others. Finding God's love after abortion. Cradle My Heart Radio with Kim Cattola. Call toll free at 800-811-3003. Seeking to help others find God's love after abortion. Cradle My Heart Radio with Kim Cattola. Call toll free at 800-811-3003.
We are here for you tonight and glad that you are here listening and joining in the conversation at 1-800-811-3003. We're talking about redemptive giving. And one of the things that is so beautiful about this, I had someone ask me recently, you know, I know that the child lives in my heart. I know that the child that I will never see this side of heaven is alive in my memory, and I want that. And I have good memories because I have done some things, you know, whether it would be to plant a tree in a child's honor or attend a memorial service for the child or give altar flowers at church in memory of the child. There are so many loving gestures. The possibilities are endless. But how do I access my lost loved one? And the answer is through Jesus Christ. And through our prayers to him, via writing a letter to the Lord about the child, expressing your godly sorrow, asking forgiveness, sharing a loving thought directed toward the child. It could be something tangible like that. It could be giving service. But these are the ways that we can, in faith, remain connected through this bridge of heavenly hope that only Jesus can provide for us. 1-800-811-3003. After abortion, redemptive giving is definitely something that leads to our healing. A generation ago, someone was saying this to me recently, and I think it's very true. A generation ago, there wasn't a crisis about the need to find purpose. I think that in our time, especially, and I think probably abortion policy has probably contributed to this by making us central rather than asking self-sacrifice, in the face of an untimely pregnancy, by instead saying you must take care of yourself and it's perfectly fine and there's no moral, need to consider this any further. There's no need to consider that there's another human being involved. If you missed the first half of the program, we'll have the podcast up, and you must listen to Frances Beckwith making the case from logic that human inclusiveness demands that we reject abortion and protect the children. But if we get so centered on ourselves, we are bound to feel rudderless. We are bound to be searching endlessly for a good purpose, no matter how we're choosing to spend ourselves and dedicate ourselves, because it's in service, it's in giving that we find our joy. You know, Jesus said this so many times and in so many ways, that whoever would be the greatest among you must be last. Serve. Decrease. Put the needs of others before your own. And as we seek to do this through redemptive giving, the joy somehow appears. It's one of God's natural laws. I don't understand it. But when we move beyond ourselves, we find ourselves filled with joy. Maybe it's going to be doing something like sponsoring a child through a Christian outreach like Compassion International or World Vision. Maybe it's going to be volunteering at church in the children's ministry, seeking out and helping the poor in your area. 1-800-811-3003. Let's go to the phones and welcome Jean to Cradle My Heart Radio. Hi, Jean. Thanks for listening.
Hi, Jean. I just have a deep concern about what you're speaking about this evening. My husband and I have provided foster care for young children and boarding care for young ladies who were preparing to give birth. And I have found that amongst a lot of our church people who are vocally, verbally anti-abortion and will even support anti-abortion effects with their finances, they do not prepare their young children. Whether they think that the kids are old enough to know about it before they're in junior high, our girls are getting wrong facts and wrong information much, much earlier than that. And our churches are not providing good information for the parents to share it. So the kids are learning from other kids and from TV shows and from I don't know where. But there's a great gap about learning about sex in God's way at an early age at home.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I think prevention is truly key. And it's not just, Jean, even as I'm listening to you speak, I think that, we've all known people like the woman at the well. Maybe some of us have behaved that way in a different time before Christ was the Lord of our lives. And we understand that, there's a need that drives that. And generally, if it's a fathering problem, if a young girl has not gotten the attention that she needs from her father, if she's not been taught her true value, and if she's not been loved in a way that she understands that she actually is valued, these things, you're right, they're all the responsibility of the parent. And for us to, again, try to heal people after abortion, all of those things will need to be healed if abortion becomes, the solution that people choose. So you're absolutely right. And I appreciate you bringing that to light, because it's a wake-up call for parents. And I don't think I don't know, fifth grade, fourth grade? Where does that conversation even begin in our culture? It's getting younger and younger. Jean, thank you for your call. Stay on the line and we'll get your address so we can send you a copy of 40 Days for Life, What God Has Done and Imagining What He Can Do. This is a book of true stories from the movement that's changing hearts and saving lives one prayer at a time. Friends, if you have an abortion in your past, I know that God sees you in a very different way than you perhaps see yourself. And maybe if your story was looking for love in the wrong place, maybe if your story was not understanding what true worship could provide to you, it is not too late to start. Our Lord, when He saw and helped this woman identify her issue as a worship disorder, allowed her to give the testimony, "He told me everything I ever did." She proclaimed His vision of her as one who was finally seen for who she is. We don't have to hide, and we can't in the end. So please begin whatever you need to do to get your healing today. Go to cradlemyheart.org, look for the links for organizations that are willing and available to help you, and believe Jesus loves you, and so do we. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.